And welcome to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM. Actually, this is the online version of Radio Free Thinker because we're not on the air this week. CITR is airing the Homeless Marathon. Nevertheless, I am Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
I'm Don, your political science philosopher.
I'm Rob, cognitive psychologist and reviewer of scientific articles.
And I'm Daniel, the economist student.
The economist student. Excellent.
Does that mean you study the economist magazine?
Oh, I totally beat you to that stupid joke.
This is the online secret content that our listeners only get from RadioFreeThinker.com.
And just think, it comes free.
Well, for now.
It's not like we're ever going to make money off this. Although, if you're willing to donate, we probably aren't going to say no, but it just occurred to me that we don't actually have a way of doing that. Someone should get on that. Daniel, it's your job now.
Why am I?
You're the economist.
Yeah. Use your economy powers.
Well, I will make a supply and demand graph for our donations.
Perfect. So, Rob, you mentioned you review scientific stories. Have you reviewed anything interesting lately?
Well, in my usual trawl through the newspapers of the world this week, I found an article in The Telegraph from the UK with the headline, "Homeopathy should not be funded on the NHS, says report by MPs." And the NHS is the National Health Service, which in the UK is basically the medical insurance system there, which allows you to get treatment from your job or whatever for any number of treatments. And homeopathy is covered by the NHS. And this report, basically put together by a committee of MPs, the Common Science and Technology Committee, basically says that homeopathy is bunk. It costs £4 million a year and it doesn't do anything and people should stop using it.
Can they say that without getting sued?
excellent point.
MPs are allowed to say anything they want.
Wow.
It's parliamentary privilege or whatever it's called.
The other thing about it is that the committee has reports, part of the reports is quotes and figures from large, well-respected organizations. So it's not just single people saying this, and that's how the British libel laws can be put into action to sort of quash the things that one single person is saying, like Simon Singh against the chiropractors. But they have the British Medical Association saying that the use of homeopathy cannot be justified on the current evidence. The Royal Pharmaceutical Society of Great Britain says there's no possible reason why such treatments could be effective scientifically. Basically, like, they just have too much power behind this report for anybody to say, well, just so one guy.
So how many people are actually using this coverage on their healthcare?
According to the article, it says that each year, 54,000 patients are treated each year at four homeopathic hospitals in London, Glasgow, Bristol, and Liverpool. So it's just a lot of people paying a lot of money every year to take treatments that do not work. I mean, this follows pretty recently. The WHO put out a report with the help of Sense About Science, also in the UK, saying that you should not use homeopathy for anything.
And it's also, I believe there was a very recent homeopathy overdose protest in the UK, wasn't there?
Yeah, that we actually should have reported on that. We apologize to our listeners. But it was the 1023 homeopathy protest where British skeptics organized this sort of, primarily in the UK, but I think it was worldwide. There might have been some Australian skeptics involved and other ones, where they basically overdosed on homeopathic pills. They went to public areas and they grabbed, you know, they went out and bought buckets of homeopathic pills from pharmacies. This was a protest against Boots, which is a pharmacy in the UK that sells homeopathy, and they have publicly admitted that it doesn't work. They just sell it because people buy it. So they took as many pills of these homeopathic sleeping pills that they could eat, in much the same way that James Randi does in his talks when he's traveling and giving talks. And, of course, nobody died. And it was basically just this huge publicity stunt.
It's a miracle, then. That has to be proof that God exists, then, too. So not only...
doesn't this just support the homeopathic companies, like these people buying tons of their product?
Short-term gain, long-term loss.
Well, I'm curious, though, what did the homeopathy companies have to say about this? Obviously, they had to say something. All these people taking their products?
They actually released some press releases that basically said that the way homeopathy works, it allows you to take as many pills as you want, and it's always the same dosage. So the dosage of one pill is exactly the same dosage as if you took 100 pills. To which I thought, well, that makes sense, because zero multiplied by any number is still zero.
I wonder if these companies have any issue with people black marketing their thing. I mean, if I took a bottle of homeopathic medicine and I diluted it, would I still have the same effect? You know, so, you know, judging by this dosage thing, you know, I could sell black market homeopathic medicine.
I think that would make it just more powerful, because isn't it the more diluted it is, the more powerful it is?
Depends on if he shakes it.
Yeah, you have to shake it in that magic way. Ten times in each of the three dimensions. I don't know.
Would you even need to do that? Because you said one dose is as good as 100 doses. So wouldn't it fall that 1/10 or 1/100 of a dose would be just as effective? So just as long as there was one molecule in my bottle of water that came from the original, I'd still have all the dose I need?
You are assuming they are logical.
Not to mention that at the dilutions that homeopaths recommend, you are pretty much, I think it's, I don't remember the exact number, but you are very unlikely to find even a single molecule remaining of the original material. And so with this report coming out of here, I'm sort of, you know, like I read it and like, wow, this is great. I hope this spills over to the States, to elsewhere in North America, around the world, and people will finally start realizing that homeopathy is something that you shouldn't waste your money on.
Actually, there was another thing I might bring out, just dealing with this directly. Richard Dawkins did a show a couple of years back called The Enemies of Reason. And one of them was him visiting one of the official government clinics of homeopathy in the United States and talking to the doctor. And the doctor essentially saying, I don't believe in this either, but the patients seem to feel better. And even if it's like a placebo effect, then maybe it's worth the money.
Well, it does bring up an interesting question, though. I mean, what is the ethical, you know, standpoint in selling a product that you know doesn't do anything, but, you know, seems to make people happy?
Exactly. And that's where Dawkins was not exactly kind to this doctor. And he was polite to him in person, but of course...
Yeah, seething rage beneath the surface, right?
Exactly.
Well, speaking of seething with rage and at doctors, what's the news out of Belgium, Rob?
So if anyone remembers, a while back there was a story of... a Belgian man named Rom Huben, who had a car accident over 20 years ago, and he was in a coma, or at least he was diagnosed with a coma. It turns out that he actually had locked-in syndrome, and his doctor, Dr. Stephen Lores, claimed that he was able to communicate intelligently through the use of a computer with a facilitated communicator. And locked-in syndrome is when you appear to be in a coma, but actually you are fully conscious. Your body cannot move. Your body is paralyzed, but your mind is completely active and you're perfectly lucid. So he brought in this facilitated communicator, and there was some news footage of her doing her thing and him communicating with his family members. And basically she holds his foot, if I remember correctly, and basically he can tap his foot, and she helps him do so to tap out messages on this computer. And this is something that has actually shown up way in the past when lots of parents were worried about their kids being diagnosed with autism and they weren't saying anything, they weren't communicating with them. So people came up with this idea of facilitated communicating, where people would come in and hold these children's hands and help them tap out messages on a keyboard. Well, skeptics looked at this and went, hold on, this looks like a prime example of the ideomotor effect, the same effect that is the workings behind things like the Ouija board spelling out messages. You unconsciously sort of move the thing around to tap out messages, you know, without being conscious that you're doing so. And so people said that, hold on, this is not a case of anything real going on. Well, there was some kerfuffle over this, and a lot of people got very angry. But Lores has finally conducted proper tests of the facilitated communicator. And he basically told Linda Wooters, the facilitated communicator, to leave the room, and they showed a bunch of objects and words to Rom Hooban. And then they asked her to come back in and ask her to help Hooban type out what he saw. And Hooban failed every single trial. Or rather, the facilitated communicator failed.
This story has basically been making the skeptical rounds throughout, you know, the blog sphere and the podcasting world. I think that the big concern I have is that the doctor in question seemed to basically imply that this particular case of facilitated communication was wrong and this was fraudulent, but he did not go as far as to say that all cases of facilitated communication is, you know, pseudoscience or, you know, a con artist at work here.
Yeah, it's sort of like James Randi calls them unsinkable rubber ducks. You can bat them down by some very strong piece of evidence, like this test of facilitated communication failing completely, but they'll pop back up again and say, well, you know, that was just a one-off instance. All these other ones, these anecdotal ones, were probably still working properly. And it's just like, well, you can't really say that. You have to prove each and every case. It's not something that you can say, well, this test didn't work, and this test didn't work, and this test didn't work, therefore, this test might have worked, we just don't know. It's more likely that none of them work.
Well, what they're doing is they're sort of moving the goalposts. You give them one piece of evidence, and they say, oh, well, that doesn't account for this case. And then like, well, what about this piece of evidence? And like, no, this case is special and such, right?
Yeah. I mean, like, one thing that actually really pissed me off about this case is that he was, as far as we know, truly diagnosed with locked-in syndrome. I mean, he was diagnosed with a coma. No one anything for him for 20 years, and someone comes in and says, hey, this guy might actually have locked-in syndrome, and he's actually completely conscious. And then this completely ridiculous, totally debunked facilitated communication comes along and wastes everybody's time when we could be actually, you know, studying locked-in syndrome, helping Hooban actually communicate with people in the outside world. But it just wasted everyone's time, and now, you know, even after this test, his doctor is still saying, well, I mean, she didn't do it properly, but someone else. It's sad.
Is it possible that
very annoying.
Is it possible this person is self-deluded? Did they actually believe they're helping somebody? Or do you think they are just a con artist?
Well, I mean, I tend not to assume people are con artists. I tend to assume first human error before malice. And there really isn't too much evidence to go on in this case. But I think that she, like all the other facilitated communicators back in the 80s with autistic children, really truly believe that she was helping. In the same way that people who are using a Ouija board may really truly believe that they are receiving messages from beyond, or someone who uses a pendulum to determine, or someone who's dowsing really believes that it's working. It's sort of your own body fooling you, your own unconscious processes fooling you. So I'm going to assume that that's what happened here rather than malice aforethought. But I mean, if she goes out and tries to do this again in a slightly different way to someone else, then she should have the hammer brought down on her, because that's not cool.
Well, that's definitely interesting. Well, so you have to keep an eye on this particular case. Well, why don't we switch gears a bit? Don, you...
Before we switch gears, we should listen to a few station IDs and ads.
Hey, Quentin and Dave from Chips With Everything.
Hey, Heather from Queer FM, what's up?
Well, you know how Bryce, our program director here at CITR, has kind of been riding all of our asses about making promos for our shows?
Cha! Yes!
Well, you know, I was thinking, like, over at the CBC, they have this woman named Promo Girl, and she comes on once an hour and tells everybody what's coming up, and it's usually kind of theatrical, and she has, like, a really sexy voice and stuff. So anyway, I was thinking that I'd really like to have a promo boy, or like, promo boys. Would you guys be up for that?
Sure. What do we have to do?
Just tell people about Queer FM, really.
Okay.
Queer FM features news, views, current affairs, arts and music. for, of course, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities and all its allies. Heather Kitchen hosts Queer FM Sundays from 6 to 8 p.m. on CITR 101.9.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com. Be a good skeptic and listen to Radio Free Thinkers every Tuesday at 4 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the Helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the Helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The Helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
Now back to our show, Radio Free Thinker, the missing episode.
Tell me about overpopulation. What were you talking about?
Well, you know, I was sitting there and I was thinking to myself, you know, there are so many problems in the world these days. There's shortages of food, there's climate change, there's oil. You know, we could solve all of our problems if only we could get rid of all the people. Okay, I know what you're saying. That just might be a cure that's worse than the disease. Well, at least from our perspective. And that said, in the world, like I say, we're obsessed these days with things like climate change and peak oil and pandemics, and we're so worried about that. Yet, one thing that seems to have fallen to the sidelines that people don't talk about so much, they used to talk about quite a bit, is the idea of population control. So I was thinking that maybe we should just take a look at global population, how it's defined, what problems there are to it. Is it possible to have unlimited growth and solutions if we don't think that's true? So we should dive right in then.
How many people are there in the world?
How many people do you want there to be? You tell me, how many people do you think are in Canada right now? Daniel?
About 35 million, I think.
Okay, Ethan, how many people on the planet?
I would say 6.2.
And Rob, you get the easy one. By the end of the century, how many people do you think there'll be on the planet?
By the end of this century? Too many. I'm going to say like 10 billion. Maybe?
Well, it depends on your studies. The population of the planet at 1000 AD was 265 million. Beginning of 1900, it was 1.5 billion. Ethan got it correct. Current population is about 6.5. Most projections have the population by 2050 at 90 billion. And depending on your population growth, we're looking at close to 14 billion by the end of the century.
Oh, no.
Holy crap.
Now, of course, all this big numbers is because of a thing called the exponential growth or doubling effect, right? As humans, we tend to understand the idea of linear growth quite easily. But when it comes to exponential growth, we tend to get really, really screwed up. For example, one of the classic examples, if I did a job for you and I gave you two options to pay me, I say you could either pay me $1 trillion or you could give me one penny on a chessboard and double that amount for every square on the chessboard. Which one do you think would be the better way to go? Intuitively, a lot of people tend to think, well, the chessboard, because, I mean, it's only a couple of pennies. How much could be at the end of it? Well, at the end of the chessboard, and, of course, someone can correct my math here, it works out to be 368-ish quintillion dollars, or a billion dollars.
And again, that's a lot of money.
And I accept cash only, so...
God, I can't believe you missed that opportunity to talk like Carl Sagan.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, he never actually said a billion.
As that's true, yeah.
So we have this idea of doubling time. Now, what that basically means, there's a way you can figure it out. You take your population growth or your percentage growth of anything, and you take the number 70 divided by it. So... if you have 1% growth, 70 divided by 1 means every 70 years or every 70 cycles, you double what you got. What that means for us here is that if you had a population of, let's say the Maldives, have population growth of 5%, that means their population doubles in less than 15 years. The current global population has a growth of about 1.17, so that means it doubles about every 60 years. And like I say, if you're really optimistic and you get a 1% growth, then you're looking at about every 7 years. Think about that number. That means that we're at 6 billion now. By 2070, we'd be at 12 billion. By 2140, it's 24 billion people on this planet.
At some point, you think it's going to reach, you know, it's going to go past sustainable amounts of resources on the planet for anyone to live properly.
Yeah. I have to wonder, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but maybe you can correct me, Don, but isn't sort of like population growth sort of based on trends? For example, like the baby boom after World War II, or like, you know, it's influenced by like the Great Depression and then like a world war that, you know, kind of flattens the graph out?
Well, there's actually two big issues that are in this. So one thing, and like I say, this is the tricky part of exponential growth. Is that even if you have a very small population growth, it still doubles in a fixed amount of time. So, like I say, we have a very small population growth in quote-unquote the developed countries, but it's still more than or about 1% per year. That still means you get to these big numbers in a relatively short period of time. I mean, I'm not going to have to worry about it, but grandchildren are definitely going to worry about it. There's an inevitability about it. You don't get it is when you start having a zero or negative population growth.
Just to like go back on that for a second, if you have 1% population growth, and I'm kind of doing the math in my head here, that means within about it, the life of someone born at that time, the population will double.
Right.
The average life for sort of first world countries.
Exactly. Now, of course, this in itself, I mean, you could sit there and you could, some people say, well, who cares? It's lots of people and I like people. But there are other issues that go into this. The idea of an ecological footprint. Now, ecological footprint, for those who may not know, is sort of the amount of land that a person requires in order to be provided for his needs. So it's not only, you know, the 1 square foot that I need to stand, but how much land is required to grow the food that I need to eat, to provide the water I need to eat. And this is where you get really, really huge differences in numbers. So the footprint for someone who lives in the United States, for example, is 9 hectares. Now, 1 hectare is considered to be about an average sustainable level, but again, it depends on the level of living. Canada has one that's 5.3, China has 1.8, India has 0.8, and Venezuela, of all places, has 0.5. So essentially what that means is that, you know, that's how much land you need. The second aspect that comes to this is the idea of carrying capacity. Now, you may or may not know this, but the planet Earth is of a fixed size. It may actually grow, I think it grows maybe a millimeter every couple hundred years or something because of debris coming in from space. But because of that, there are fixed capacity. So this the number of people that you can have on it depends largely on how big the land is. So right now, if everyone lived like the Chinese do right now, we can handle a population of about 6 billion. If we had if everyone lived like the Americans did, you'd only be able to have maybe about 2 billion people. Of course, if you lived like the Venezuelans, you could have your 12 or greater number of people because they don't consume as much, so they don't actually need physically as much land.
So I guess the question is sort of, what quality of life do we want the majority of people to have?
Exactly. No, and that's actually the huge, huge issue. There is another aspect too, because there's some people who like when you're dealing with the carrying capacity, there are renewable aspects, so like farmed crop, and those really can be quite variable. I mean, improvements to production methods and all that may make those at least sustainable, if not perhaps even more. But there are the non-renewable or natural capital of the planet, things like ancient aquifers, oil, that kind of thing, right? Another thing that can affect efficiency, as I say, is technology, and who knows where technology is going to be. One of the great miracles of the last century was the Green Revolution, which allowed for a lot of the population growth that we have right now. By using genetics and artificial fertilizers, they doubled production of crops between 1960 and 1980.
Wasn't it, of course, more than doubling?
It depends on where you are. So the stats that I had said doubling, but I would, if you want to say more than doubling, sure, I can.
Because I remember reading that in some countries, it was almost 5 times or 6 times growth.
I think a lot of that has to do based on what they had to begin with, you know.
Exactly.
So again, so a lot of it deals with carrying capacity. Now, another area that some people talk about is the idea of difference between population size and population density. For example, who knows what the third most populous country in the world is?
Is it
India?
Is it?
No, sorry, that's wrong.
United States, I'm sorry.
Rob, do you agree?
Well, I'm just trying to work backwards here. I'm thinking that the most populous is China. India is probably up there somewhere, second or third, followed by somewhere in that area, I'm guessing. An Asian country?
Daniel?
I'm torn between an Asian country and the U.S.
Okay, well, Ethan obviously knows his history well, so his geography is bang on for some reason. Yes, the United States is the third most populous country. It's only 308 million people, but that clocks it in at number three. Now, you also noted that China and India are number one and two, although by 2050 that's expected to be reversed, with India having a larger population than China. That said, population density is how many people you can squeeze into a piece of land, in which case something like Bangladesh, which everyone thinks is a hugely populous country, is probably the one that you might have been thinking about, Rob, when you're saying, well, is it or isn't? Well, it does. It has an incredibly dense, it's like 32,000 people per square kilometer.
Holy.
Yeah, and I mean, that's huge. And actually, surprisingly enough, some of the most densest areas in the world are things like Singapore, Hong Kong, and the Vatican City. But of course, these places aren't terrible places to live. Not that Bangladesh is, if there's anyone out there. But population density, population size are not really relative in this thing. They don't really reflect population size. It's just how crowded people are.
And I guess sort of the resources in that area. Like Vatican City, I mean, it's a small piece of land that's relatively easy to administer, as opposed to like Mexico City, that's quite huge, right?
Much harder. But yeah, and actually that's one of the things. So if we sit there and we say, okay, we're going to have a population sometime of 12 or 24 billion, if it's not going to be 50 years from now, 150 years, it's coming, until we have a really significant change in the way we do things. What are some of the things we need to worry about? Well, some people say, well, population density, we're just going to become a more crowded place. And you're going to get things like crime and psychological issues. Or another thing is the idea of hotspots for disease, breeding ground for diseases. Now, I think these are real issues, but we have them now. So I don't really think that's where the big issue is. Another false flag, I call a false flag issue, is the economic area. And Daniel, I think you did some research into this, but let me tell you what I have first, is the idea that we have an aging population, and the way most Western societies and even non-Western societies feed and keep going, provide the benefits for the elderly, is to have young people pay for them. And as long as you have more young people paying, then the old people can live off of their excess, so to speak. However, you know, if you have fewer young people and much more older people, then of course you start having a deficit. You can't afford this. This is something that Japan right now is experiencing. It has very low population growth and very low immigration. So this is true. You know, you're going to have this thing. But I think it's a false flag, because eventually, somewhere down the road, you're going to have a point where you will have no more population growth possible. Just hitting the hard curve of
like
reality.
That's just what I've been thinking of. It's like reproduction requires resources. And as the amount of population increases, you know, competition for resources increases. I think this was like discovered by some guy who just thought about it briefly way back in the day, the 1700s. I think his name was Jeremy Bentham or something. Maybe it was someone like Adam Smith. But he saw, you know, the same thing. Population increases exponentially. Resources increase maybe geometrically. There's always going to be competition for it. But you're going to eventually reach a plateau. You can't reproduce indefinitely.
The person who said that was Thomas Malthus. He was some influential church intellectual of, I think, the 18th century. And yeah, basically what he said was, and he has been more or less proven wrong so far, that there is a huge problem with population going up exponentially, with resources not going up. But the thing he missed was the strong effect that technology change would have. So basically before that, the economic models of the time more or less only had labor and capital in them. Nowadays, we realize that technology will dramatically change how much we can produce. And so while there's some truth to that, that our resources won't be going up exponentially, there is a little bit of a strong argument, at least up until now, that technology helps match the population growth, if not exceeding it.
I think one of the things, though, that Malthus missed as well, and that I think we do have to worry about now, is the idea that there are things that are, like I say, referred to as natural capital. So there are things like oil, and the effect that oil's had in the area of fertilizer and mechanical production has dramatically improved the ability of the earth to produce things. But there are limits to these things. There's another issue is irrigation, and India, for one, although like I said before, is expected by 2050 to surpass China as far as population, may not get there because it also is believed before that point to have drained its non-renewable aquifer, the water in the ground that's been there for millions of years but doesn't replace itself. When those aquifers go dry, they will no longer be able to irrigate a lot of the land that they brought under cultivation, and you'll actually have a receding of the Green Revolution in many parts of the world that have enjoyed it.
Just to sort of throw in my two cents on that particular point, I seem to recall reading that actually a decrease in access to resources is more likely to cause people to have bigger families and more children, because that affects the birth rate, and therefore you have more children because your infant mortality rate is worse off.
Well, we're kind of jumping ahead a bit here, because in a way you're right. There are many different solutions to it, and part of the problem, if I can call the problem, is the idea of inequality and one's life expectancy. I was watching a documentary recently about how they were talking about starving people in Rwanda, and the guy had 15 children. Granted, five of those were adopted, but even at 10 children, I'm going, well, no wonder you don't have enough food. You've got 10 children. But, of course, that's the knee-jerk Western reaction, because the reality of his particular situation is odds are eight of those children are going to die from disease or from some other aspect, and that he's going to need the ones that do survive to provide his own thing, because there is such a dearth, elimination, absence of social programs or health care or such, having large families play into that.
There's actually something, it's a little off topic, but there was this interesting study that I found. I forget where it was, but it was by a guy called Charlie Reeve, who has been doing a lot of, he's been gathering statistics on religiosity, fertility, and IQ in various nations around the world, and found this sort of correlation between increased religiosity and increased fertility rate. So you get more fertility and more people having babies in countries where religiosity is higher. So could one way to possibly solve this overpopulation problem in a way of getting people to stop having babies is to continue spreading the ideas of atheism, or at least a religion. Something that occurred to me, but you know,
as everyone knows, one of my high horses is the idea of atheism and how religion is, if not the root of all evil, it is sure as heck one of the main streams of evil. But I did find out one thing. When I was looking at doing the research, there are three basic approaches to dealing with this. And one of the places that's renowned for its approach, if I can use that term, was Iran. Because of its theological government, it has the ability to be as autocratic as China is in its one-child policy, which we'll get into later. But apparently it has made mandatory sex education and birth control education on that. Not that I think they've done a good job of it, but sometimes it can be used for that. But you are right. Places like Nigeria, which is expected to triple or quadruple its population in the next 40 years, is one of the places where, you know, it's just the religiosity of it plays into it. The United States, when I was also doing the research for this, most of the people who were against the idea of overpopulation weren't against it because they disagreed so much with the numbers or all that, but they were worried that it would lead to increased abortions and birth control, which obviously is part of the whole solution, and they didn't like that for religious reasons. So yes, I would agree with you that if we got rid of religion, it would be a much better place.
When I was actually looking up the idea that people, you know, are thinking that overpopulation is a problem that we need to solve, and there actually is something called the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement, where they basically, their logo, their slogan is sort of, may we live long and die out, you know. And they're completely serious, and they advocate for women and men to voluntarily have ovumectomies or vasectomies or whatever, and basically stop having children, because children are just you know, contributing to the problem.
Well, you know, actually, Rob, I was doing a bit of my own research, and somebody that I've been reading actually said that in order to get the Earth population to a good level, we would actually need to have zero population growth for about two or three generations just to get us back to a sustainable level. So I think there might be something to the notion that we need to kind of curb population growth for a while, and that might necessitate making people interested in, you know, voluntary sterilization.
Yeah, so do we need a program like China's one-child policy?
Well, actually, you know, there are several possible solutions to population growth. There are active options, which we're kind of hinting on. China has forced family planning that they call China's one-child policy, which essentially, if you have, you're only allowed to have one child. If you have more than one child, they essentially fine you and they deny you social services and you have to pay for them. And the idea is that, you know, it's trying to drive down the population. And ironically enough, it's been incredibly effective in China. Of course, oddly enough, there are some unexpected consequences of it, because you're dealing still with a relatively traditionalist culture, that the number of men to women in China, I believe, is anywhere from four or seven to one. So not only are they getting sort of the benefits of restricting to one child, but they're going to get a second round of reduction because there's just not going to be enough couples to go around.
Though there is reports of problems such as, you know, people will have sex. It's really hard to stop people from doing it. And you will have more than one child. And there's, you know, cases of children being abandoned or even murdered in China because they don't want to be affected by this policy. So
it's not the best solution. It's so far it's proven to be the most effective solution. But that being said, you're right. There are huge problems with it as far as ethical aspects to it. There was another incentive tried in India where they used economics. They paid men to get vasectomy. And this was really good. They had, I think in 1 year, they had something like 800 million vasectomy. But what they found out, the problem with that was that the majority of people getting the vasectomies had already had four or five children, and they were just kind of cashing in on this at the end. Although, in another odd sort of way, going with China, apparently in India, at one point, in a desperate attempt to try and make this program work, almost any offense in India, the penalty for it was a vasectomy. So jaywalking, you got a vasectomy. Littering, you got a vasectomy.
There was a lot of problems with that program. And even if it might have been slightly effective at slowing down population growth for a bit, and very slightly effective, it was one of the major reasons leading to the toppling of the government of the time. It was extremely unpopular.
That's quite true. So those are so far the only active methods of birth control I've heard, but there are also passive methods, and we've kind of alluded to this before. One is higher education. There is a strong correlation between the increased education, especially of women, and reduction of population. There's also the idea of a better standard of living. As we said before, one of the reasons why people will tend to have a very high number, a large number of children, is because there's either high infant mortality, low life expectancy, or economic insecurity. So again, if you can elevate people's standard of living, that tends to reduce birth rates. Of course, the irony of it all is that you need to have more stuff in order to increase the standard of living, and the more people you have, the less stuff there is to go around.
So, Don, I think we're talking a lot about sort of like, you know, the environmental problems and sort of, I think, on a bit of a small scale. But what about like big problems? Are overpopulation going to result in like more war and political instability and, you know, massive civil wars?
Well, you know,
and we'll get back to the answer to that great question after another advertisement.
CITR News is committed to providing you with in-depth Olympic coverage from an alternative perspective. As part of this coverage, we are launching a new Eyes on the Street feature, where Vancouverites will have a chance to tell their Olympic story. We want to hear your perspective on life in Vancouver during the Games. That's why we're inviting you to be CITR's Eyes on the Street this February. If you're at an event, a protest, a celebration, or even simply on the bus, tell us about it. There are three ways to file a report. Call our Eyes on the Street hotline at 604-822-5334. Email news at citr.ca or tweet CITR News. Then sit back and wait for your report to be featured on the next edition of News 101, which airs Monday and Friday at 5 p.m., right here on CITR, 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
And now we're going to go back to our Radio Free Thinker podcast in progress.
The government of the time, it was extremely unpopular.
That's quite true. So those are so far the only active methods of birth control I've heard. But there are also passive methods. And we've kind of alluded to this before. One is higher education. There's a strong correlation between the increased education, especially of women, and reduction of population. There's also the idea of a better standard of living. As we said before, one of the reasons why people will tend to have a very high number, a large number of children, is because there's either high infant mortality, low life expectancy, or economic insecurity. So again, if you can elevate people's standard of living, that tends to reduce birth rates. Of course, the irony of it all is that you need to have more stuff in order to increase the standard of living, and the more people you have, the less stuff there is to go around.
So, Don, I think we're talking a lot about sort of like, you know, the environmental problems and sort of, I think, on a bit of a small scale. But what about like big problems? Are overpopulation going to result in like more war and political instability and, you know, massive civil wars?
Well, you know, actually, that is the other thing that's been going into. We talk a lot about peak oil, and we talk a lot about the idea, you know, the Iraq war was for oil, or the Sudan civil war has been propagated for oil. But there's another idea that's called peak water. And the idea is that the amount of water on the planet is relatively fixed. You know, there are no meteorites landing to give us extra water. So the amount of water we have is limited. And everyone needs so much water every day to live. Therefore, at some point, you know, we're going to have to be fighting over it, because there are lots of parts of the world that just don't have enough water. So the next round of wars are going to be over things like water. They're going to be over things like food. So, yeah,
some people say that all wars are just about basic resources.
That's an excellent point. Exactly. And, of course, as we kind of mentioned before, although I kind of dismissed it a little bit, with increased population density, people need someplace to live, even if, you know, so you get population migrations, which lead to tensions. A lot of the elevated racism that's occurred in Europe is because its native population is declining. It's making up for that by increased immigration, but there are cultural conflicts because of that immigration. So I think there is. I mean, I think the one thing that's true about all of what we said is that eventually we're going to hit a limit to the population growth, that at some point either it's going to be running out of food, running out of water, air pollution, something, the technological wizardry of humanity will at some point itself hit a wall, and we'll have to start reducing the population. But of course, even if we agree we need to reduce the population, there are a huge number of ethical considerations that come into this, and is actually partly the basis for a lot of resistance to get the whole idea of population overpopulation. When people start talking about overpopulation, people assume somehow you're meaning it in some form of negative or unethical way. One of the biggest things is the whole north-south divide. Because of the fate of the world distribution or whatever, a lot of the quote-unquote extra population of the world are in non-white areas. And so if you say, well, I believe in population control, that instantly translates into, oh, you're a racist and you just want to get rid of all the dark people.
Well, I mean, just this whole time I've been thinking about, like, I mean, there's all these sort of horrible final solutions to the population, you know, overpopulation problem. And I was thinking, what if overpopulation effects can be mitigated or avoided altogether by sort of increased funding and research into cool tech that will sort of mitigate those problems? I mean, if it's going to come down to resources and space, go colonize other planets. If it comes down to over oil, you know, we're doing all sorts of research into stuff that means that we don't need to use oil anymore. Renewable resources, you know, sustainable things. If we go to, if it's over water, well, maybe we just need to pump more research into better filtration systems so we can reuse some of the water that up to this point we haven't been able to reuse. I mean, it's sort of like the sort of sci-fi fantasy story of, oh, science will save us all. But it seems like there's a real chance that there's something that we can do with more research and tech that will mitigate these problems long enough for us to come to a consensus about what to do about it.
Well, without a doubt, their scientific advances will help more people live in the same amount of space, hopefully at higher levels of comfort. But the problem is a lot of this technology costs a lot of money. And so certainly like countries like the US, Canada, Western Europe and stuff could help lower their sort of footprint, the amount of hectares each of them requires to live through technology without greatly diminishing their standard of living. It's still not going to be cheap or even possible to get that technology all the way around the world to all the other countries that need it. And and other things like colonizing other planets, well, I don't think that's going to happen for a while.
Yeah, I mean, like that's unfortunately the problem is that that overpopulation is already a problem. And we can't really afford to sort of sit around and hope science is going to, you know, fly in and save the day. That could take 50, 80 years, and in 50, 80 years, we may have another billion people to, you know, feed and house and protect, right? So I think that, unfortunately, we just can't hope, you know, a planet's going to float by that we can, you know, pass off some of the burden. Because, again, it's a big enough problem getting four people into space. Imagine getting, you know, a million people into space.
It's time to build the ring world, you know.
The numbers you're actually be looking at would be closer to 4 billion people or something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're pointing to a very interesting thing there, Rob, is that we have this sort of blind faith that technology has solved all our problems in the past, therefore they will solve them all in the future. But that, of course, is an inductive fallacy. Just because things have worked in the past, there's no necessity that it will work in the future. And honestly, there's a certain point where you're going to say your luck runs out. There are a number of civilizations in the past whose luck had run out. I mean, there are Mayans,
the Incas, the Aztecs.
Well, the Aztecs were killed by, and the Incas actually were killed by Spaniards, but
well, yeah,
the Khmer people.
Because they wanted their gold.
The point is, I mean, if you have a disaster looming because of population, the problem itself is going to cause, you know, instability, and instability, you know, whether it takes the form of like an economic depression or a world war, is not necessarily conducive to, you know, new technology being developed that's going to save the day.
There's another issue that comes into this is one of the things. It's a legacy of the Victorians or of classical economics, is the idea of continual growth, that there's a necessity to always be bigger and more next year, and maybe that could be sustainable in the area of economics, because we're not going to go into that area. But in population, there's a certain point where, like I say, you run up against hard things. Until we do, we have space colonization, and who knows, maybe in 3,000 years we will have that, knowing NASA's budget problems. But going back to some of the other ethical issues that come in, I mentioned the North-South divide. There's also the developed-undeveloped divide, and we touched on this before, is the fact that, you know, in the developed nations, we have a population that probably is sustainable more or less if we work at it a little bit. But in the undeveloped areas, again, they have these huge population growths. And if they try and live up to the same standard of living that we have here, I mean, China, for example, is enjoying great growth in its standard of living. Unfortunately, that's just tearing even greater amounts of resources away from the planet, meaning that there's even less carrying capacity for the planet. So we talked about before, there's the idea of, you know, what standard of living should we be pointing to? And I think most of these, again, if we in the developed areas are quite willing to allow our standard of living to drop a bit, to allow immigration, so it's just not all the southern, quote-unquote, southern countries that suffer, that we do. Canada is a big country. We can take a lot of people. Now, if we take the people, they can't just be replacing them. Because, again, I told you before, with the idea of population density has nothing to do with total population. So even though Canada may have a very low population density, it won't stay that way if other countries keep producing people and we keep immigrating to Canada. It just shifts the problem around, doesn't change the problem.
Well, isn't already sort of the problem that is happening in the developed West, and I think we kind of touched on this, is that it actually isn't helpful for us if we have zero population growth, because the baby boomers retire and people aren't taking their jobs, so we're risking economic instability. So we kind of need immigration to bring in skilled people to take those jobs, right?
Well, and again, that's based upon what I think is somewhat of an antiquated idea of progress. Again, the Victorians were great on this, is that every day we've got to do a bit more than what we did yesterday. And one of the big movements in economics and is the idea of a steady state economy, is that you can have economic prosperity without necessarily having economic growth. So instead of sitting there and producing 1,000 more widgets next year, you only produce 100 widgets, but maybe they're better widgets, so that, you know, you don't need to have a bigger market. You're relying upon the idea that every year we have to have a bigger market. And again, that seems unsustainable.
Yeah, this kind of, I guess, takes us to another topic along the same line, or sort of on different lines, actually, because this more or less only occurs in countries where population is decreasing. And that's the sort of economic problems of an aging population. Japan is obviously sort of the biggest example of this. I think they're, by 2050 or something, they're expected to lose about 20 million people. Canada, even though having a sort of natural population decline, if we didn't have immigration, immigration keeps us growing a little bit. The big problem with this is that total economic sort of output depends on labor, capital, and technology. So as a population gets older, labor obviously decreases as people retire. So the total economic output of a society, assuming that the amount of capital doesn't greatly increase or that technology doesn't greatly increase, could start going down without less people actually wanting the outputs of it. So one way to look at this is in Canada, currently, there are 5 people of prime working age for everyone retired. So that means that there are 5 people working in the economy to make all the goods that they and the retired people utilize. By 2033, that's supposed to go down to 2.5 prime working age people to 1 retired. So obviously, in about 25 years, we are going to have a dramatic shift in Canada. There's sort of the major problem of that is the very basic economic problem, and that is there will be less labor to produce for an increasing amount of people. On top of that, though, there's also sub-problems of in states where a lot of the services that older people need is paid for by government, it won't be the savings of those retiring people that go into paying for their care later. It will have to be paid for by the taxpayers later, and that leads to a whole bunch of issues of ever-increasing taxes or less care for older people.
Actually, you know, you bring up 2 things. First of all, I'm glad to see that you recognize, too, the eventual collapse of capitalism. Woo! But beside that editorial comment, I find it interesting, and I'm surprised you didn't bring this up, Rob, is that we assume that technology is going to solve all of our food problems or what have you, but we don't seem to think that technology will be able to help at all with our labor problems. If we look historically, that actually reliance upon human labor can actually be a huge detriment. I mean, one of the things that's believed to have prevented the Roman Empire from actually achieving the Industrial Revolution back then was its reliance upon slavery. We all know, of course, that in the Confederate War, in the United States Civil War, that one of the things that was a detriment to the economic growth of the South was its reliance upon slavery. We have a society that's based upon human labor, which, of course, you can't get rid of totally. But, I mean, in Japan, one of the growing areas is robotics, and robotics in senior care, for the exact reasons that Daniel's mentioning, that there are just not enough young people to go around. So they're offloading the labor of a person onto the labor of a nearer person or a robot.
Exactly. This gets to sort of what I'm going to talk about now is the problem, as I said earlier, the economic output depends on labor capital and increases in, or changes in technology. So if labor is going to go down, the only way to keep economic output constant or preferably increasing is to increase the amount of capital or new technology. And but the problem is the way the current system works in most sort of Western nations, because they have sort of these social security nets for older people, for retiring people, is that they are not saving up. They're not saving for their retirement. If they actually were saving for their retirement, or the government was saving for them, there would be more investments into these capital changes needed, or increases in technology, and this would help to alleviate the problem of their care later on.
So we've been talking about how the sort of these economic problems, these social problems.
Hello, and another small interruption to give you yet another commercial intervention.
CITR loves its friends. Having a Friends of CITR card entitles you to awesome discounts from businesses in your community. Maybe downtown is your stomping ground. Present your CITR card at 212 Productions Limited, Beat Street Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, Hits Boutique, Dream Apparel and Articles for People, Scratch Records, The Fall Tattooing, Flaming Angel Designs, Spank Clothing, Heart and Soul, Pacific Cinema Tech, and True Value Vintage, and receive great discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
I wanna love you and treat you right.
Into these capital changes needed or increases in technology. And this would help to alleviate the problem of their care later on.
So we've been talking about how the sort of these economic problems, these social problems, and how technology might be able to help it. But to get away from sort of white people problems, you know, to put it bluntly, and bring it back to what Dawn was saying earlier about these sort of ethical issues of the developed, undeveloped, north, south, and that sort of thing. And the prime example of what the possible effects of overpopulation can be is in Africa. You know, you have massive overpopulation in Africa, low education because no one has, you know, enough resources or money to afford an education. They're basically subsistence farming to live. It's plagued with disease, AIDS, poverty, hunger. And just to sort of wrap up with a more, I guess, inspiring look at how people can you know, solve problems of overpopulation in a very local way. There's this kid, William Kamkwamba. He gave a TED talk. You can look it up. You can go to movingwindmills.org. And basically, he, in 2002, in the middle of the worst famine in Africa in 50 years, this kid was struggling to survive. He was forced to drop out of school. His family couldn't afford food, let alone the $80 a year tuition. And he decided, based on a book that he took out of the library, to build a windmill. He built it out of scrap parts. He just learned how to do it himself, built a windmill and a generator, and it powered some light bulbs and radios in the compound that he lived in. And this spread. And now he's basically, you know, going around Africa helping these people deal with some of the problems that overpopulation causes by, you know, sort of bringing them education and technology through this very simple method of just building stuff out of scrap to help power the places they live so that they can learn more, automate some of the work they're doing, make some money, get food, and, you know, you're off to the races.
No, it's a wonderful story. But you see, this is part of the problem, is that there are small little things, but it doesn't negate the fact that there's this hard barrier that we'll eventually have to hit. So again, I applaud this person and his attempts to make the life of his fellow people. But how much scrap is there going to be around to build how many windmills? And at what point do you just run out?
I hope our listeners have enjoyed this rather depressing talk about overpopulation on Radio Free Thinker's first ever 100% internet episode. And I hope that our listeners...
Which I believe will be edited heavily.
Yeah, we're going to take out all the parts where Daniel talks.
Ouch.
But, well, I guess actually we should probably sign off now and advise our listeners to listen to this episode at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to tune in next week on 101.9 FM CITR at 3:30 for Radio Free Thinker at its regular scheduled time. And this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying, I hope you can harness your wind.
Oh, jeez. This is Daniel saying... No, stop laughing. This is Daniel saying, make sure to check out a special presentation by CFI Vancouver, hosted by our own Don, Wednesday, February something.
February 24th. I was going to say something, but I didn't want to toot my own horn. Thanks, Daniel.
No problem.
Bye, everybody.
Good night. You do.